ధేయదివాన యో అస్యాద్యక్య పరమేభ్యో మన్ సో అంగవేదయదివాన వేద ఓం శాంతి శాంతి.
Welcome back to the last session of the day. That was the, as you haven't already guessed, the chanting of the Nasadiya Sutta. And I thought it would be remiss if we didn't hear the richness of it being recited in Sanskrit. And like for that purpose, I think it was mentioned in Rembert's class, and the idea of the sound vibration, and in Dr. Lipner's class too, is having a purificatory effect. It's something in the sound is to evoke an effect, and that is, in this sense, a purifying atmosphere. So I thought that might be at least a good place to start. I'm aware, too, that you're tired, that you're hot, and that your heads are full of many, many different ideas, and there's a lot going on, and so I'm loath to, you know, to dive into any great in-depth dissection of the Nasadiya Sutta. So what I thought we would do, if that suits you, is just we would read through it once all together, and then verse by verse, and I would just throw it back to you, to more a discussional, looking at it and thinking, from what you've heard together of ideas of creation, from Hindu stories, from Vedic ritual, from different ideas or philosophies within Hindu traditions, does anything come to mind? Can you make some connection with that? You've had many ideas around creativity. In one sense, creativity is everything. You know, the temple is a form of creating sacred space, a womb-like embodiment of the divine, whereby you are reborn. And then there's the processional, the creativity involved in the class you had on the Tamil processional, how the deity comes out and is received in the public. It's a creative interaction between the devotee and the deity. And in Rembert's class, very much the sacrifice is all about creation. In fact, in different senses, it recreates, maintains our very existence, the world, and in a sense ourselves, by enacting the ritual. And then the Vedic ritual is just one context of understanding ritual action, you know, right action. Ritual done the right way brings about a result, the right result. But then in the whole myriad banyan tree expression of Hindu traditions, you get this idea of ritual action bringing about a result in many different contexts. I was having lunch in a cafe today, and I hope I don't bring the tone down of the Hindu discourse and Professor Lipner's metaphor of the banyan tree as an image for Hinduism. I had a more mundane, pedestrian one. There was a table beside me with a group of cyclists came in, and thus ensued a whole discussion on, you know, coffees, cappuccinos. And the man came with a tray and he said, "I'm very sorry, this cafe has a strange, he's a very different latte. The cappuccino and the flat white are pretty much the same." And so thus ensued this discussion. Yeah, where's the foam? Where's the foam on that? A flat white is not supposed to be so milky. It's supposed to have less foam. And I was fascinated. They all got into it. And a cappuccino was for one of them. A latte was for the other. The flat white was for the other. Espresso was for the other. The whole team of cyclists. And it just struck me, again, we're talking about Hindu traditions, you know, in one sense, yes, respecting the old, the traditional, the cup of coffee, and at the same time, how it has been kind of innovatively presented in different forms, the little bit more foam, a little more froth, a little more milk, you know, three shots, two shots, one shots, you name it, and yet it's all having a cup of coffee. So it struck me similar with ritual action. You've got the Vedic context of the ritual action and how that's very much centered around the fire sacrifice and the precise enunciation of mantras and all the various of the performance of the instruments and all the various elements that comprise the ritual action. But then we see in the Brahmanas with Rembert, you saw that idea of performing, it's good, but what about the knowing bit of it? You will actually gain Prajapati if you understand. So the Brahmanas moving towards the ideas in the Upanishads that we see, the idea that it's not simply just do it, you know, like the Nike, the Vedic Nike. You just do the ritual, you get the results. No, it's like, well, you got to know what's that power behind the ritual. What's the power that makes it happen? So there's a little bit of a know thing going on, to know or to understand. It's not academic knowledge. You must understand what are the connections behind how things work. What is this power? And of course, the celebrated great connection in the Upanishads is the idea of the something behind the everything is the Brahman, and that in within is the Atma, and in some sense they are connected. This power behind the all is there, residing in the many. So this idea of the whole and the many parts is a recurring theme played out in the different sacred texts and traditions. And then we moved on to the Puranas. I was talking from the Puranas and a little bit about the Itihasas, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And in the Mahabharata, we find the Gita. Here, you have the idea of ritual action, again, expanding beyond just the sacrificial arena to all action, like in the Upanishads, all action that you perform will bring about a result. And that's the idea of karma. So karma just means action, but all action in all of your life, and I suppose that's encapsulated mostly beautifully in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9. It has this yat karoshi yadashnasi. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer, whatever you give away, do that as a sacrifice. Do that as an offering. So it becomes an expansion of the idea of ritual action to all action. And particularly in the Puranic context, in the Mahabharata, you get this idea of the centrality of the deity of Vishnu. And that's where you get this whole idea of bhakti as the devotional addition to just act, just know. And it's added this whole bhakti dimension. So if I'm to just summarize before we move on of some of these very big recurring themes, it's if you think of the self, the little, it's like you have here, you know, in the nature of all of us, there's a thinky bit and there's a feely bit and there's a doy bit. So if you think about it, and the whole lot is integrated, and we see ideas of Hindu traditions. So for example, the Vedic ritual focuses on the what bit? The do it bit. Just do it. Do it, and it's right action. You just do that action and you do it right, and then you get the results. Now, that's not to say it's devoid of any thinky bit or any feely bit, but it really is, if you were to put it in parentheses, it's the just do it. It's emphasized, and in smaller letters you could say, as yes, there is understanding involved. You need to know the mantras. You need to have some little bit, you have to have confidence and faith that this is going to work. So it's not devoid of it. And certainly you could say that there's some love or bhakti, heart, feely bit, when you read some of the Rig Veda hymns in glorification of Indra and Agni and Soma, there's certainly, you can find the roots of it there. So that's the Vedic context, ritual action in the Vedic context. It's a creative act focusing on the do. And then moving on to the Brahmanas, the Upanishads particularly, you're talking about the knowy bit. But in Hindu tradition, knowy bit isn't just academic collection of information. It's an insight. You get it. You understand. And it's understand what? Well, what is they're talking about? What is the something behind the everything? What is the invisible, you know, power behind not just the Vedic ritual that brings results? What is the something behind the sun, the moon, the stars, the world, the us? What is that something? And it becomes a who or a what. And the Upanishads battle with this. It's like, and some, it's very beautifully expressed in various dialogues, and sometimes it says that if you think too hard about this, what will happen to your head? It'll shatter apart. So sometimes if something is too far for human understanding to grasp, you find this too in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 11. Poor old Arjuna, you know, he's having a nervous breakdown on the battlefield, and to help kind of let him understand what's actually happening on the bigger scale, Krishna reveals his cosmic form. But what happens there? Yeah, he can't take it. He's reduced to a trembling mess. It's like sometimes divine, it's too much to handle. So he just has to come back and be his chariot driver. So the who, the what is being asked. What is it? Who is it behind all of these? These questions are being asked in these texts. Then in the Puranas and in the Itihasas, which are the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, these great stories, you have the who is very much, who is behind, is. And that's typified by the story of the churning of the milk ocean. That's a very good example of the kinds of thing you find that smack right at the center. You'll have, that's a Vaishnav text. So in the Shaiva Puranas, you'll have Shiva there, and there's also the goddess traditions of the Devi Mahatmya. You'll have similar stories, but the who is behind it, introducing the bhakti element, that you can't go it alone. The do it doesn't do it, the know it doesn't know it enough. You have to have another factor. Because once you have the deity, the who is behind it, you're bringing in a whole other dimension of relationship and exchange. And like we saw in the churning, you have like, well, in human failure, and that was something we see in that story, and in all of the Puranic stories, they're almost stories of time and human failure. Who is the supporter? Who is the maintainer? Who is the one who revives? Who is the one who protects? Who is the one who inspires? Who is the one who energizes? And then we get this who is, in this context, is Vishnu, Shiva, or the deity. So, simply speaking, the creative acts are this. The creative act, just do it, with the others in smaller print. The know it through yoga, asceticism, meditation, just observe, you can know it, you can understand it. But that also has, you know, you have to act in a certain way, you have to have certain decorum, the social behavior still exists. And of course, it's not devoid of feeling. But the big highlighted in kind of in italics is to know, is knowledge, understanding. And then this one is the more the bhakti, the idea of, yes, they're important, but the heart bit, the bhakti bit, is very important. Okay, so that's just recurring themes you'll see going around, where they're all there, but some are emphasized more than others. And I wanted to put that there before we read this text. So as we read through this text, just bear in mind those kind of questions, you know, who is the, or what is the, behind the everything. There's the manifest and the unmanifest, what we can see, what we don't see, and how do we make sense of any of it. Okay, are there any questions before we start? Is that okay? Is that more confusing or clarifying? Okay, so the Nasadiya Sukta, this is from the Rig Veda, and it's not a typical hymn that we find in the Rig Veda. The typical ones are more praises extolling the glories of Indra, Agni, Soma, Varuna, the gods that I think that Rembert spoke about today. But it's atypical in that sense. And in many ways, it's more... it contains the material and the mood that you find in the Upanishads. And for that reason, some scholars will say that it's a much later edition. It's in the 10th book, which is a later edition and perhaps transitional in the style, moving towards more Upanishadic style. But let's see what you think. So how we'll do this is, I think if we just start here and we'll take it verse by verse and read it round once together first and then go through each of the verses. Okay? So off you go. You can now be the sages and the seers looking out there, and let's just sort it out once and for all, and you could go home tonight.
Okay. At first was neither being nor non-being. There was not air, not yet sky beyond. What was it wrapping? Where? In whose protection? Was water there, unfathomable and deep?
There was no death then, nor yet deathlessness. Of night and day there was not any sign. The one breathed without breath, by its own impulse. Other than that, there was nothing else at all.
Darkness was there, all wrapped around by darkness, and all was water indiscriminate. Then that which was hidden by the void, that one, emerging, stirring, through power of ardour, came to be.
In the beginning, love arose, which was the primal germ cell of the mind. The seers, searching in their hearts with wisdom, discovered the connection being and non-being.
A crosswise line cut being from non-being. What was described above it? What below? Bearers of the seed there were, and mighty forces, thrust from below and forward move above.
Who really knows? Who can presume to tell it? Whence was it born? Whence issued this creation? Even the gods came after its emergence. Then who can tell from whence it came to be?
That out of which creation has arisen, whether it held it firm or did not, he who surveys it in the highest heaven, he surely knows, or maybe he does not.
Okay. First impressions? It's confusing. It's not clear. It's speculative. It's not spelling it out quickly. It's who is speaking this, do you think?
Good question.
A guru?
The seeker of some sort, isn't it?
Yeah. It's and we see, are there any mention of seekers in this?
It's like, the mind. It's like the person who introduces the mind before the Indian mime dance.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an introduction to the event.
It's like an introduction to the... Okay, Nopi, look at verse 4. Just say.
We have to... The seers.
Yeah.
And it's important... It's interesting that they've mentioned that they had to look in their hearts for the wisdom, not just their heads.
Hmm. Yeah, there's something, there's a searching going on. So it opens up its beginnings, it's some at first. So, and it's a double negative. Nasadiasi nosad. It's like at first there was neither being nor non-being. So it's already messing with your head in one sense.
Definitely.
It's like, it's like... So, what was there? Is it saying there was nothing there?
Not for certain.
Yeah, even that. It's not crystal clear there was nothing.
It's not clear, because it's saying, was water there? So it's like, it's saying, is there water there?
Mm-hmm.
So it's and that's something. Water is something.
Okay, so you're right. It comes up to the water on the fourth one. Before that, it defines it by what was not there. Now, you see this sometimes in the Upanishads, this idea of neti-neti, that the indefinable, invisible something. Well, because you can't really know what it is, it's not this, and it's not that. And it's so you see this here. There was not air, and there was not sky beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So, what was its wrapping?
Yeah, what a question.
Yeah, it's like, so you have three questions there. Kim, Kuha, Kasya. It's like, what was it enveloped? What enveloped it? So it's kind of reaching for something, even though there's nothing there. Why is it asking the question if there's nothing?
When it uses the pronoun it implies there's something there.
Mm. Kind of like that, exactly.
It's asking what the wrapping is.
Exactly, so it's grasping at these kind of questions. And even where, So there's three questions. Kim, what? Kuha, where? Kasya, in whose protection? Okay, or who guarded it? Who protected it? So, it starts off with the biggest questions,
If there's no being, then there can be no non-being either, can there?
Hmm.
Exactly.
That's nice.
So straightforward. What you're saying is it's not inconsistent.
It's a kind of potential.
But then does that mean there's nothing?
Yeah, there to be something for there to be nothing.
Because there's no distinction. There's,
but then,
there's only the
so
one.
It's just like,
there's the one, if you want to use that.
But what's the one?
Yeah, two.
Yeah. Well,
it's
human understanding
and
words.
It's beyond.
It sounds beyond like the what?
Beyond our understanding.
Yeah.
It sounds like something.
So we're there.
Yeah. We come out of there, but it's beyond. We can't understand what was there.
No.
Okay, but we're there. Who's doing the understanding?
It's not clear right at the beginning if we're there. Or
we're there in the love, because we understand the love.
Okay, well, let's just move on. Let's move on. So, okay, let's see. Verse 1. Don't know what's going on. So there was a rapping and there was a kind of a what, a where, and in whose protection. But you're right, someone mentioned there was water. So we have an affirmative statement here. There was
it's
water.
Question,
it's still a question.
It's a question.
Very good. Was water there?
Somebody trying to describe an experience.
Because it's a question. Yeah, was water there unfathomable and deep? So even that's, you know, not hard and fast. Okay.
There was a breath, though.
Oh, we're not there yet. So someone who didn't read, want to read the second verse? Jyoti. Actually, I missed Alison. Did you? You got skipped. Just the second verse now.
There was no death then, nor yet deathlessness. Of night or day there was not any sign. The one grieved without breath by its own impulse. Other than that, there was nothing else at all.
Okay, can we add anything to the questions?
There's something about the way the dualisms are presented. So there was no death, not yet deathlessness. It's like, you know, when you have himsa and ahimsa, or duality and non-duality, you don't have an opposite in the sense that we have the opposites. So that when you were trying to explain non-dualism, when you said pantheism, right?
By analogy,
that's the best we can do in a way. But that's not actually the same, is it?
No.
See, that's the thing. I'm fascinated in this because being or non-being, it's not death and life. It's death and...
There are no opposites, it seems. There's no... So that's just not clear. In that sense, there's nothing to be an opposite of. Yeah.
Right. And then the fact that there isn't means it's very hard to define.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's like, in one sense, it's beyond our comprehension, what we know that's not in some way defined against something.
Could we not take that the other way around? Where there's life, there has to be death.
Mm.
Where there's life... Yes, you do. That's about the same thing, but...
Take it the other way around.
What's it saying?
That there is no life here.
You're saying there was no death then? Oh,
no deathlessness.
No deathlessness. That there is no duality at all. It's not a life and death thing.
Yeah,
neither with it.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay, and then yes.
It's almost like he's trying to say that they have to spell it out so you don't assume. If it just left it as there was no death then you would assume, well, maybe life is continuing. So then it has to qualify that by saying no deathlessness, and the same as, you know, being, as you would say, well, there wasn't any being.
There was nothing to die from, because, you know, there was no...
But it's not saying there wasn't life, it's saying not... Again, it's this negative...
Yeah, it's not saying there was no life, it's saying there was no deathlessness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. See, there's a subtle thing. It's like the being and non-being. At first there was neither being nor non-being. It's not saying there was nothing, and yet... It's playing in the same way with that. So what?
But deathlessness, doesn't that mean immortality?
Yeah.
Yes, if you're comparing it against something. It's just leaving it, there was no opposites.
If we're saying there was no death, neither was there immortality.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah.
You could say it like that.
What's the Sanskrit word?
Of deathlessness? It's amritam, yeah.
Amritam.
So immortality.
Yeah.
It's like somebody trying to describe an experience which is extremely difficult to communicate.
Yes.
Mm.
Nice. Okay.
There must be something.
Well, let's move on. What about how the second way something happened? There was no of night or day, there was not any sign. Okay, again, there was no differentiation there either, it seems.
Mm.
Aha, but then we have... Ani davatam, the one breathed without breath by its own impulse, svadaya. So tad ekam, it's by its own breath. So there's something happening here. Other than that, there was nothing else at all.
So there is only the one there when...
We have, yes, anid avatam, the one breathed. So the one, the whole, the undifferentiated something.
The
that,
supreme
being? We're not there yet. but it's just interesting because... But you can see, what I'm hoping this will do, you can see how in Hindu traditions, in its cappuccinos, lattes, you know, and flat whites, have unpacked these, you know, in different ways, at the same time catching the spirit of it.
Ah.
Yeah, okay, so something breathes. Moving on, without any breath, by its own impulse. So there's something independent there, by its own, not dependent on anything.
You know, this is about Sanskrit, and yeah. The word for Atma, I don't know what it means, but in German, the word Atma means breath.
Mm. Life air. Air can be that, yeah. Yeah. So, yes, I mean, we look back, again, like these stories, is this a story of cosmic creation? Is this a story of human birth? Is this a story of consciousness emerging? Is the again the multivalent or the different many layered ways of reading this text? It just plays upon your psyche, and let's see what your creativity comes up with. So moving on, anyone have something else to say on that verse?
We're still on number two.
Number two. So the one breathed without breath by its own impulse. Other than that, there was nothing else at all. So that's a... darkness. Continue.
Darkness was there. Sorry,
W. Jyoti.
Darkness was there, all wrapped around by darkness, and all was water indiscriminate. Then that which was hidden by the void... That one, emerging, stirring, through power of ardor, came to be.
Okay. Now, anyway, and the word for ardor there is tapas, by the power of tapas. Anyone want to throw light on that verse?
Well, this isn't the thing about tapas, is we talked about its relationship to asceticism, but it's also about the fire.
Mm.
But also the fire is about desire, which is what we talked about a lot yesterday.
So it's, go ahead.
So it's, I mean, I'm sorry to bring it up, but you just can't help but think about the first chapter of Genesis when you...
I was wondering, does anybody have any Hebrew?
I have some Hebrew. It's Tohu
Bohu.
Sorry? It's the chaos.
Yes,
and actually,
but the water is—it's not almost an exact parallel.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the breath in the Hebrew is ruach, which is wind, and it means spirit as well.
Also, it's atma, spirit, is in the same way. They have that. Well, atman is there too.
But he also there's separating the waters.
Yes.
Because the waters are indiscriminate and unfathomable and not. And there's a separation of night and day, dark and light.
And yet this predates, this must predate the
Hebrew. What's the dating on this?
Well, that's very, we're talking BC centuries, fourth, fifth, yeah.
But it's not necessarily.
Even some would put it much older than that.
Because again, they were passed on orally. It's only later that they were written down, so it's difficult and there's big, certain debate, but BC, yes.
Tradition puts it back at 5,000 years.
Yeah.
But philologically, we can only go back to 500 BC. But you know, it was in oral tradition before that. So, but it's definitely a fact that Judaism came from England.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on. Good, I'm glad you're connecting with this. So there's a positive statement too about water. Remember before the question of water was raised, it's like, was there water all around? Now this is saying, okay, there is some here.
And what do they mean by water indiscriminate?
Undifferentiated, just like all, it was indistinguishable. It's like that's all that was distinguishable was water in some sense wrapped around.
How many water words is it? Is it alpha?
No, salilam.
It's salilam.
Yeah.
To me,
does that mean fluid.
Can I come in?
Yeah, you can. Please do.
To me, it's sort of the first three verses are just talking about a void, a total void.
Yeah.
But then it starts putting things in there.
Yes.
Yeah. The breath.
Yes.
With its own impulse.
Yes.
And then the water.
Yes.
Which is indiscriminate. To me, it means all surrounding.
Yes.
And that's where the churning might happen.
Yes.
Next. So in a sense, that it's already putting things in a void.
Okay.
It starts off with the void as for example.
Yeah.
And then starts
adding into this.
It.
So, yeah, we're beginning to have water and there's something in... Yeah, the void. That's very nice. The void is beginning to fill up a little bit.
Yeah.
And there's a stir. We have breath first. And then there's heat. Exertion, tapas, desire, ardor. It's a form of ardor, could be enthusiasm, love. It has many nuanced meanings, but some form of heat, exertion.
It'd be interesting to know which word they were using for the one in this place as well. Was it ekam? It wasn't ekam.
Ekam, yeah.
It is ekam.
Yeah, let me see. Ardor the Great, Lotus, Double.
What's the word in Sanskrit for the one being used here?
Yeah, the question. Yeah.
Coming into being, just bear, hang on, and I'll tell you exactly. Three. Yeah, we should have done the transition. Finishing with that, which coming to being.
Okay, recording.
Ekam.
It is
Ekam. Yeah, Ekam.
Yeah,
yeah. Ekam.
Yeah.
It's there. Same.
Ekam.
Yes. Okay. So something's happening. Moving on to the fourth verse. Would someone like to read that?
In the beginning, love arose, which was the primal germ cells of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
The seers, searching in their hearts with wisdom, discovered the connection of being and non-being.
Okay. So here, again, it's in the beginning. The word for the love arose is kamas, tad agre. So agre, in the beginning, there was kamas, desire, love. Again, it can be nuanced, interpreted in different ways. And samavarta, it came into being. So it arose, it emerged, it came into being. Which was the primal germ cell of the mind. So in some sense, there's a sense of something, a seed emerging in the mind. The seers, and that's the kavayo, the kavis, searching in their hearts with wisdom, discovered the connection of being and non-being. So what do you make of that?
It's sort of describing the start of the search for what the heck's going on here, you know, isn't it?
Yes, something about finding in the... You know, the evolved world in the unevolved world, the manifest world, you're finding it in the unmanifest. There's a something there, there's a connection between what you can't see and what has emerged, what's visible, the visible and the invisible. And these are recurring themes in the Upanishads between the how, yeah, there's some connection, hidden connection between them.
Even in this level, you can see where Samkhya came from, can't you? Where it talks about... the unmanifest.
The pradhan.
Mahat.
Yeah, and, well, the idea of the pradhan and the prakriti is manifest, and there's the unmanifest material energy. So, yes, that sense in Sankhya is the same, that the material animals, elements are kind of activated and emerge from an unmanifest condition.
Yes, from the one impulse, wasn't it?
Yes.
In verse 2.
So you can see the connects with that.
So that was hundreds and centuries and
later,
thousands of years later,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
But also love is in the heart, and the heart is considered to be the bridge between the material and the spiritual.
You're searching in their hearts with wisdom. So again, that's interesting. The word Sriddhi is there. It's in the hearts. So it's a searching for wisdom, but it's not just a wisdom of I get. It's a holistic sense, like here, of searching in the self, the deepest self, in the heart, for understanding. It's that kind of knowledge. It's insight to what's the connection between the visible and the invisible? What's the connection between the unevolved and the evolved? What's the connection between the unmanifest and what we see? It's the deepest questioning that, you know, we can do.
Isn't this inconsistent with the wisdom portion, where wisdom is in the mind, and love is in the heart, whereas it's now saying love arose as a primal germ cell of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas searching their hearts with wisdom, which means in a sense wisdom is linked with the heart.
Well, both. It's like you mentioned the word Atma, but they can be understood in three ways. The Atma can be the mind, the Atman can be the self, the soul, or the non-physical. It can be the heart as well. It can be the body. The Atma is the self holistically and has been used slightly differently depending on. So it's that more holistic understanding of where understanding takes place.
One of the things we're now filling up the void with the seers as well.
yeah, exactly. Nice. So what have we got? We got breath listed for. We got what? What came first?
We got the one who breathed, the water.
Breath came first, and there was water.
Yes, and then seers.
Uh huh. But there was an impulse as well. The one breathed by some
ardor,
sort of
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have ardor that came to tapas is the word and kamas.
Then beach.
Okay, and then
was
we have
the beach one or the animal.
No, it's not the retam. Yeah.
The seers
really
jumping
the line, doesn't it? Like between 3 and 4 there, because it's sort of switching from thinking about what there was before to. How we're coming to think about it.
Yeah. It's so there's a kind of a, if something's coming into being now, emergence is here. Okay, the next person want to read 5 and we'll move on.
A crosswise line cut being from non-being. What was described above it, what below? Bearers of the seed were there were, and mighty forces thrust from below and forward. Move above. There you go.
There you go. Crystal clear. What do you think they're talking about there?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Who are the bearers of the seed is one of the
questions. Okay. So they're like generators or impregnators. So you've got kind of the image of seed bearers and powers, and there's a below move and there's a forward above move. So you've got this sense of, yes, movement coming about, and there's a seed impulse and there's a recipient, so there's a meeting of both. So you could say a generative image, and I mean that could be understood in on different levels too. But there are forces, one from above, one from a thrusting from beneath, and there's a seed involved and there's generation.
The current universe works with forces, therefore the introduction of forces is very interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and again, it started with the breath, it started with, you have the ardor, the tapas, and then the kamas, desire or love, and so there's energy and movement taking place now. So,
Go
on.
It's a disjunction, isn't it? A strange disjunction, I don't understand, between the last line of verse 4 and the first. They discovered the connection between being and non-being, but then they, presumably the seers still create a line between the two.
Yeah, it's the bandhu is the actual, the line, the connection, you know, sato bandhum asati, so it's being and non-being, there's a connection. Again, it's kind of dealing with the something invisible and the visible, and how the two are connected. What's that line that keeps the two together? Mm-hmm. And it's the seers can see that, or in one sense cut through that line and see the connections that lie there. And this is the whole idea of what understanding is. I think back to Rembert's class on the sacrifice, the one who knows these connections between Agni. Remember they were speaking about Agni as the fire, Agni as actually the gateway to the gods, Agni as the sun, Agni as the one who brings the gods, makes them present. Agni in different connotations, Agni as the fire in the home, Agni as the fire in the self, Agni as the mouth that needs offerings to be. The different connections between what you see and what's beyond our vision. It's cognitive. I mean, there's here you can find, and it's the seers can make those connections, and that is wisdom, the person who can make those connections between what's unseen and what's seen, or what's being from non-being. Anybody else got something on that? Above it and below. Forces,
why does it say cut? I mean, cut means there's an action that is intentionally separating.
Okay, what do you think that means? It's like a crossbar cut non-being from being. They're no longer separate.
It's like this is a linear, time-orientated, or a precursor to that. And it's talking about, like, cutting through that, suggesting that there's something beyond that.
Yeah. Anybody else got something on crosswire cut?
It's saying what was described above it and what below. So it's almost like a way of saying that there is a difference between being and non-being, and you have to try and understand it by separating them and then try and figure out, you know, what the difference is.
Mm-hmm. And then cutting that crosswire between the two of them being separate or held apart. It's like the connection is, you can see the two, or the two it emerges. But it's not clear. It's not that it's suddenly, aha, because then it's, what was described above it? What below? The questions are still there, still being asked.
In five, the introduction of below and forward is the introduction of the two primal directions.
Uh-huh.
So we need the other two as well yet. I mean, the space is made up of four directions.
Oh, yeah, the four directions. So, but that's true. But this is the visible and infinite.
Above and below at the moment, right?
Right.
So that's also being introduced. In a sense, it might have been a void, which means there was no space either.
Mm.
So when it started, the space came up. So maybe it came up first that way.
Mm.
I don't know. That's what I had seen being
implied. Who knows? Okay, sorry. Anybody else have something?
Square connection with the Brahmacharya Sutta. In the Atharva Veda, where the student is learning and maybe crosses the line between ignorance and wisdom, and then goes forth and spreads his seed, which is a bit unusual idea in that he's not achieved the Grihastha, he's still a student. His creative power is spread, I think, on water as well.
Okay.
So all of these images in that rather obscure hymn, to which I'm...
So you're linking it with the procreate, but it's also there too, the procreative act, and a holding within, because that was also in the Atharva, actually later developed in the Upanishad, the idea of the brahmacharya, or the celibate student.
Yes, he's gone through the process of education.
Right.
That would be maybe achieving wisdom.
Yeah, it bears fruit.
Quite a lot of tie-up, image-wise.
Yeah. Again, multivalent on different levels, you can read this.
That's right, the cut could be, you know, the introduction of time, which, because that's what breaks the infinity into in another Upanishad about how time is the dimension that flattened the greater world and created the illusion of the material world.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps that's the cut.
That time begins, things come into time. Yeah, you could maybe read it like that. It doesn't explicitly mention it. Moving on to six, then.
Who really knows? Who can presume to tell it? Whence was it born? Whence issued this creation? Even the gods came after his emergence. Then who can tell from whence it came to be?
Okay, so again it's ka, ka. Ka, who knows? Ka ada veda, ka iha pravachat. Who can presume to tell it? And kuta ajata, whence? So whence did it come? Where is it from? Whence issued this creation? Kuta again. So you have a kaka and a kuta. Where did it come from? Where did it issue from? Vrishti. Where did it issue from or emerge from? Even the gods came after its emergence. Then who can tell from whence it came to be? So what is this telling us? Let me light this verse.
Don't think about it.
Hmm?
Don't think about it. It's a mystery.
Okay, but it's telling us something. There's information in this.
Yeah. What? So it says the gods came after them.
Uh-huh.
So
what's it telling us?
Before the gods came.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a something before the gods. Yeah. Exactly. And there's a something, a someone, but it's still a what. There's a some what or a some who before the gods. So it's grasping beyond. So yes, then,
gods,
yeah.
Gods are added in now at this moment, yes.
Now, we see that even in the Rig Vedic ritual, the fire ritual, we saw that the devas are not the sent. They're invited to, you know, to perform the sacrifice with the sacrifice for the sacrifice. The point is the sacrifice. And it's so the devas are not the be-all and end-all. There's something more. And in that Vedic ritual context, the Mimamsaka tradition particularly, it's the power of the enactment of the sacrifices, the be-all and end-all. And then in the Upanishads, we have this grasping. Well, what you have to know what that power is. What or who is that power? And that's what we see in the Upanishads. The what is the power or who is the power in the Shvetashvatara and the Katha Upanishad. And then the Puranas and the Hathis say the who behind the everything is defined in theistic terms, like we saw in the churning. Okay, so anything else? Got something here?
I think it's interesting that it says that who can tell from whence it came, that it's saying like who can tell, as in like the system is based on Shabda, like the we understand the world based on what the, you know, the gods or like the rishis know, and then we learned through the words of higher beings and kind of discover from them, like that's our means of understanding Brahman or this one or anything by reality, that it's not like I'm just going to look at it, kind of figure it out myself. It's like if the gods don't know, then like who do we turn to for this? And it's even up here, it says that what was described above it went below, and I thought it was kind of cool that it says what was described, not what was it above, what was it below. It's the description that what have people described about it, or what have they said, rather than what is it.
Okay, and who are the people who know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Who does it? Who are the people? Is there anybody who knows?
No.
Well, look at verse 4.
Yeah, the seers.
Read that final two lines of verse 4 again.
They are searching.
The seers.
Yeah, but what does it say after searching in their hearts with wisdom?
They know.
So they got it.
That's the only thing they've discovered. They haven't actually
that's
discovered
not everything.
But yeah, but because of that, they discovered that then a cross line cut being from everything is like the separation's gone. The connection is maybe it could be taken like this. Discovered the connection, so
well,
there isn't a separation.
You only discover the parts by breaking them apart. Uh-huh. Otherwise, you don't see the thing.
Uh-huh.
So therefore, breaking being and non-being together with that cross line cut, that's when they discovered the connection between the two.
Yeah, but they discovered the connection first, and then the cross line broke.
It
was cut.
Or I feel like it could also be that it's not a sequential thing. It's a break from the chronology, and that it's saying like in the future sages have discovered this, but it's not like it's kind of breaking away maybe there.
You're saying
the sages line is breaking away from the chronology of the rest of the.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, in one sense there is no chronology in one sense if we're talking on this scale of things. It's not.
Can I give you an analogy?
Yeah.
How will a blind man find out that the car has tires? The only way he'll do is if he's given two cars, he crashes them together and then he takes the bits that come out and he feels one that's like a tire. Aha, cars are made of has tires. So in a sense these seers can be seen as blind men who break that connection to see the difference between being and non being.
Okay.
Particle
physicist coming out there. But actually, your point is good because this is one, if you're going to think of some of the big themes that you've looked at from different angles, one of them is that unity and diversity, the idea of the whole and the component parts. And I think it's Hindu what we've seen is that they are all interconnected. But to what degree and in what way is where it's nuanced. In the Sri Vaishnav tradition, the Sri Vaishnavs have their particular take. Everything is, in one sense, completely identical with the whole, the one, the supreme. And at the same time, has qualitative difference. So there is some differentiation. And then in the great traditions of Advaita, that actually there is only this one great whole reality. And the only thing that separates us from that is a form of covered ignorance, or it's an unawareness. So the whole is the ultimate reality. Or in the devotion of the Vaishnava understandings, they say, yeah, the whole is the reality, but each are little sparks of the fire that have their dependence on the full fire and have their existence in and remain ever separate. So you have different nuanced ways of trying to, you know, grapple with wholeness, oneness, and the variegated parts, or the parts of the car, as you put it. So right here in this early hymn, we have the same grapplings, and you see as the traditions emerge that there's different ways of putting that together, making sense of that. Do you put a, is it a what? Is the power behind a what? Or is the power behind a who? And if the power behind is a who, then we're talking relationship, and you get the whole idea of bhakti, mercy, compassion, relationship, give and take. And doing it and knowing it is not enough. Like the devas and the asuras who got squashed under the mountain because their own exertion and power and knowledge didn't do it. They had to have the help. So that will be that. Whereas the Advaitin traditions will have the, once you understand the coverings of knowledge, you will, aha, understand that there is only one, that you are it. In one sense, aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. So that's there too. And then the Ramanujan tradition kind of finds its place in both. So anyway, that's digressing. But you can see that the seeds of these big ideas between the visible something, the you know, and the invisible something. What you see, what you don't see. Where things come from. What's the connection between that? And how can we know? And your point, that's a nice thing you're talking about. Well, it's the ones who know pass on the knowledge. Those, and here we see the Kavis, the seers, the wise ones. They're the ones who pass it on.
I mean, I think the beauty of Hinduism is that it's a seeking faith, that it doesn't have a doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of established to not create a doctrine and to keep the larger questions open.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people who can perhaps see the ultimate reality are the enlightened beings or the seers who are able to go beyond this time, space, or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
and connect with it. But even they are limited because they can't really communicate it back to the people.
Mm.
So I think that's what this is, what protects it from becoming a doctrine or ideology, and allows this huge banyan tree.
Okay, like Julius Lipner was saying, how yes, it's adhering to traditional things, but there's room for innovation and adaptability and change. Like,
I mean, it's not even who or what is the question. So.
Hmm. Anyone else got something?
But, the seers don't see the one.
The seers don't see the
don't
one.
Don't see the one. That's what I think.
Okay.
The one is something different from being or non-being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good point.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not clear. It's not clear that he sees the one. Mm.
So that's why the seers are blind.
Well, we see. I'm just thinking. The one that came to my head. I'm just thinking again. The in the Bhagavad Gita chapter 11. What happens when Arjuna tries to see the one? Are we seeing the Upanishads when you try to work out on what is the world woven, Gargi? What is the world woven on? If, you know, it's repeated, it's a trope you see again and again. If you try to understand what the world is woven on, your head will shatter apart. In one sense, it's beyond the scope. There's something about limited understanding. When you go past a certain amount, it's impossible to see the full picture because you're within it, in a tiny part of it. So there's something about that too. Okay, the last verse.
That out of which creation has arisen, whether it held it firm or did not, he who surveys it, the highest heaven, he surely knows, or maybe he does not.
The last one is very interesting.
Okay.
He surely knows, or maybe he doesn't.
Held it firm or not.
Uh-huh. What do you think of that?
So the one there is
somebody... How the seers don't know, and even the one who was there when there was all void and there was nothing,
uh-huh.
and then this, the breath came. And if we take him as the one, the supreme one, and the seer with love, through love in his heart, he was able to take that as the supreme, and as the supreme being, and the others as the non-being. But even the seer has given up. He says that he cannot fathom
mm-hmm.
what that one is. But even that one does not know whether it's because of him that everything else is.
Okay.
Arising.
Nice. Anyone else got something?
Is the one in the highest heaven the same as the one? Not necessarily.
Say that again, is there?
The one in the highest heaven isn't the same as the one.
The supreme may not be the one.
What's the Sanskrit for heaven here?
It's, let's see. in the highest heaven. Hang on, I'll tell you now. As I'm looking for this, I'm thinking also. Hang on, I haven't written it. Paramo, the highest paramo vioman, the highest sky, highest heaven vioman. Parame vioman. The thought came, where's it gone now? What did you just say? What was the last thing somebody said?
It's the one, the same as the one in the highest heaven.
Aha. Uh-huh. No, that didn't do it. There was
the supreme may not be the one.
Not the one. Yes.
The one that is is referred here may not be the supreme.
Yeah.
That's what the last sentence tells me. He does not.
Oh yeah. Well, he does not know. You don't know. I think the point. Yes. What came to mind? I was thinking in the Kenu Upanishad, there's a very nice expansion of this. Someone, the idea of understanding. He surely knows. Or maybe he does not. And it's very beautiful. It says, the one who thinks he knows doesn't know. And the one who knows he doesn't know truly knows. And that's the... So I'm just wondering if it's throwing out that again. It's like, is it something to know? But maybe, again, messing around with the unknowable. And that the one who knows understands that it's unknowable. And at least can recognize that. Yeah, you have something, Sean?
Yeah, I'm just thinking when we read this, if it's the paramyoma, it's not, it's still considered part of the material context.
Mm-hmm.
So is it referring to the highest in the material capacity to know, or something beyond that? So that's one thing. But then the other thing is, it's kind of establishing, as the King of Parashat is establishing, an intellectual integrity that maybe we're not looking for if we're looking at it as a religious text purely. Whereas in this context, it's not simply a religious text, it's also a philosophical text. It's both together, which isn't maybe it's not how we look at the text normally. It's a religious text, then it's religious, faith-based, there's a revelation. Yeah. And maybe that's not the basis of understanding, and maybe that's what is helping us understand. So the idea of understanding that you don't know is the basis of learning anything.
Yeah.
And that's the basis of intellectual integrity as well.
Yeah.
So the capacity to question, the capacity to critically analyze, because this is being critical of everyone in our experience, is like everyone, even the greatest person might know, or maybe he doesn't.
Well, it throws it open. Yeah, it's again, it's interesting. Like it doesn't end conclusively. Only the one in heaven knows. Da 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 da. Take a bow. No, it actually opens it up. It's a and that's why this is a tantalizing hymn and has. You know, it's one of the most well-known ones, I think. Julius Lippner says this along with the Purusha Sukta, because it has appeal and resonance in broad context. You can look at this and it's like, you can try to grasp at the context in which it found itself in the Rig Veda and find that. And yet, because it's so elliptical and evasive and tantalizing in its imagery and metaphors, and the Sanskrit is not clear. It gives you these kind of, you know, poetic allusions to possibilities, and therefore you can find connection with it. So it's a very beautiful, very philosophical, speculative some in the way, you know, the Upanishads develop this idea. But yes, sorry, you have something?
As a physicist, I would say all these verses, this mandala, it's actually telling me about the Big Bang of the universe.
Okay. Okay, that's good.
Why? Because we have understood how the Big Bang developed. But why the Big Bang? Who knows? Who doesn't know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what it's pointing out.
What's on the other side of that going in, right?
Yeah. The other thing, of course, is on a very light note, if you remember, there was an American politician talking about known unknowns and unknown unknowns.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he was talking about such substantial things. I think it was a little bit. Okay, well, just to begin to round up then, we've only a few minutes. What I wanted to, just by way of a kind of wrapping together ideas, having read this, two things I wanted to do. I'm going to just give, I sometimes do this, a Bhagavad Gita card, because the Bhagavad Gita, as I said, in one sense, is like the Upanishads. It has ideas that you can find resonance with here. And I want to just, can you find any connection with the verse from the Gita with this hymn? And secondly, anything that has resonated from what you've heard so far. So two things, very briefly, just pass them out. Choose a verse. And does this verse connect in any way with this hymn? And second, does it connect in any way, this hymn, the Nasadiya Sukta, with ideas of creativity you've had so far? So what I'm trying to do is get your own creative self moving and making connections here.
I always get the same verse. I must be telling you something.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Just, we don't have much time, so just take a couple of moments. And if it's a no, that's fine. I'm just saying, if there is a yes, can you make that connection? Anybody want to go when you're ready? You ready?
It says it's about I know all beings in creation as they were in the past, as they are now, and as they shall one day come to be. Yet not one of them knows me in full. So that's clear that I think knows me in full. Me is the one. That's what I think.
And the connection with the...
Well, that you can't...
That you can't know. No one knows me. Okay, yeah. So you'd open that nice one. So the knowledge of the full, the one behind the all, is not knowable in that sense. Anybody got something? Do you have something, Jyoti?
Yeah. Mine is from chapter 7, verse 6-7. No for certain. So this is the answer.
Great, thanks, Jyoti.
That whatever is found in this creation arises out of a combination of my material and spiritual energies. I am the origin and dissolution of all. There is nothing beyond me, Arjun. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread.
That's a very famous one, the invisible thread. So you have all the big visible and the invisible. Mm-hmm. So it's pervaded that same idea. I'm sorry, is that what you wanted to... Mm-hmm. Nice. Anybody else got something?
I have something about creation. I mean, this is again typically when I've read the Gita. The only thing I've always found is that Krishna is always saying, he knows everything, he knows everything, he knows... That's what he's telling Arjuna. He's telling Arjuna how to behave and how to do his duty and so on. So in a sense, there's no element of unknown I find in the Gita. This verse actually says that to
me. Oh, good.
This is chapter 10, verse 41. Know that all beautiful, glorious and mighty creations spring from but a spark of my splendor.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it means he knows where the creation happens. He's telling him how the creation occurred. His creation occurred through his plan.
Okay, so that's very clear.
To me, that's very clear, and that I find is the theme that I see when I read the Gita. It comes through to me.
Okay, that everything is a spark of his splendor.
That's right.
Okay, nice. Somebody else got something?
You go first, because I said a lot. Mine's kind of the way not to go.
Yeah.
If you want to get to there.
Yeah.
So it's... one who contemplates the sense objects develops an attachment for them. From attachment develops lust, and from lust anger arises, and from anger confusion is born. Confusion results in loss of memory. When memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost, and when intelligence is lost, one again falls into material consciousness.
You had some connection with the...
Well... Yes, in that this is grappling with the other. And this is an impediment.
To perception.
Yeah, to perception,
yeah. That's interesting, those recurring things, Kama, Krodha, Lobha, it's like again, it's that... I think we've done this before, the idea that if you're attached to something, it's a very practical, it's not a religious thing. No. If you're attached to something, it's like that thing is there. You know, it's like that's, where is it? I must have it. Why didn't I get this? So therefore, if it's attached, you just can't see. Yeah, the attachment makes you forget. And I always think of the example of You know, when you're really attached to something and you're frustrated, you don't get it, you get to say the, you know, in arguments, you never listen to me, you always say that, you never do this, and you always do that. And the fact is, that's not true. Nobody never or always does anything. But the point is, when you're attached to, or your anger comes or frustration comes from not getting what you want in some way, your memory shrinks, your memory is bewildered, and that's how you lose, that's what that verse is saying, you lose your perspective, because your memory, your perspective, you can't see the past, because it's got something, you know, why didn't he take out the bins? Or whatever, anyway. Okay, anybody else, and we just wrap it up.
Yeah, this one, and this is chapter 2, verse 20.
Uh-huh.
For the soul there is neither birth nor death, the soul that is will never cease to be. It is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, undying, and primeval. It is not slain when the body is slain. Can we relate it to...
I'm asking you, can you?
Yeah, I think I can. I can relate it to that, you know, the eternal, supreme soul. Because that is something that cannot be understood even by the seers. And that is what he is talking
about. What's he talking about in that? For us?
For the soul.
Okay. So the non-material aspect of the self. Okay.
Yeah. And here also we have the non-material, the non-being.
Yeah, you could read it. Yeah, it's possible to read that there's a something that's not visible or unmanifest. So you could say, no, that's quite, I think, talking about rebirth, isn't it? So that's not clear in this, but there's something in unseen, yes.
Yeah, it's not talking about rebirth, it's talking about not rebirth.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So the you're right. That links with the.
Some mantra people say at the last rites of people on the cremation.
Perfect then. Perfect. There's something before the creation, before, you know, when you leave. Exactly. Right. Final one, and that's it. Any last offering?
I just read this book. It's about yoga. Oh Arjun, perform your duty without attachment, remaining equal to success or failure. Such equanimity of mind is called yoga. And I think I relate to that in my personal life, but also to this, in the sense that at the end it's going to all dissolve and go back to that void. So success, failure, they don't really mean very much in the context of...
Okay, in the context of big realities, that success and failure are small. There.
Yeah, and it's all the same. It has the judgment may be on the material, but in that there's no judgment of that's a success or that's a failure.
Okay.
And it's all the joy of being created. It's all beautiful, whether it's successful or failing.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we'll end it on that note, and who really knows?
I was in an interfaith panel, and I actually used those last two verses, and then the next person to speak, he was an imam, a young imam, and he referred to it, and he said, oh, my sister said, you know, who really knows? He says, I know. And he genuinely, you know, because of his faith, he didn't want to consider, you know, questioning it at all.
Okay. Okay.
Well, I know that Anna gave a very nice talk. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.